Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today, talking about soil organic matter, such an important factor in your soils and in your productivity plans. I've got Eric Moore with us right now, a soil warrior. And Eric, one of the questions that we get a lot is farmers are considering, should I be in no-till? Should I be in strip-till? I want to build soil organic matter. How does it compare? Because so many people think, well, if I do any tillage at all, I'm going to go backwards on organic matter. We haven't found that to be the case on our farm. What have you seen with other farmers you work with?
You know, and that's the same thing we've seen with other customers. In fact, it really has been validated by some of the university trials, long-term trials as well. I know I believe it was in the University of Minnesota, they did a several-year trial comparing the organic matter content of strip-till to no-till. And what they found is after a period of only about 5 years, it was about 8.6% greater organic matter in the strip-till plots compared to the no-till plots. And if we think about that, maybe that doesn't exactly make sense that we're doing some tillage. Why would we have greater organic matter in strip-till versus no-till? And really some of the conclusions came back to what we were doing with soil structure. If we think about the soil structure in strip-till, we're getting greater root development, greater root penetration through those soils. And it's when we think about building organic matter, it's not what we see above the ground, it's what we build below the ground that creates organic matter. So increasing the amount of root mass that those plants were able to create, creating higher yield levels, strip-till created more plant material below the soil surface and increased that organic matter at a more rapid rate than no-till did.
That is very interesting data. I found on our farm the big factor is if we're not tilling up last year's root system, if we can, say, plant corn on 30-inch rows and then move over in between those rows, do our strip-till, and plant the next year's soybean crop, for example, in a corn-soybean rotation, if we leave that root ball intact underneath the ground, we're building organic matter levels.
Yeah, and that's a great point because you would look at that and say, well, you know, if a 10-inch tilled strip can give us greater organic matter, why wouldn't a whole field tillage give us greater organic matter as well? It's because, just like you said, if we can leave that root mass predominantly undisturbed where it was grown, move over some and create new root mass there and work back and forth, we really see a great increase in those organic matters.
You know, I think the opportunity to place nutrients deep is one of the things, too. And it may sound like I'm against no-till, but I'm absolutely not. I love what no-till can do for soil. I love the protection against erosion and these types of things and conservation of water. But one of the big challenges has been nutrient placement. And that's where I see, you know, getting those higher yields like you talk about. If we can put nutrients down deep, that gives us a pretty good shot in drought.
Yeah, I think so too. And that's the thing I would look at. And it really depends on your nutrient level that you start with. I work with a crop consultant in Nebraska, and what he's finding is where they've done almost too much deep placement or have deep placement be their only practice, his nutrient levels in his 0 to 4 inch levels have dropped off considerably, and the crop is very slow in the early spring. So I'm all in favor of deep nutrient placement as long as we have a complete distribution of nutrients from the soil surface to that deep zone. I don't want to have an area where I'm very, very deficient. So I think if we can get nutrients through that entire soil structure or that soil rooting depth, I think then we get a more vigorous and robust root mass through that entire depth.
All right. Now, whenever you're talking about strip-till, and since I've got Eric Moore with Soil Warrior on with us right now, I want to ask this question. Soil testing, do you take them just random throughout the field? Do you focus right in where your strip is? How do you recommend growers go about that?
You know, and there's been a lot of conversation around that. And some of the soil labs and university studies looked at really, you know, maybe taking a percentage of them, so maybe one in the strip, two out of that strip, because we move that strip around quite a bit. So it's hard to completely avoid those old bands. But the other thing that really increases the accuracy if you're in a kind of a banded placement or the zone placement of those nutrients is make sure that you're pulling a higher volume of cores increases the accuracy. So I probably do one third of them in that old zone or in that last year's root mass or in those planted rows, two-thirds of them between the rows of the number of places that I stop.
Yep, and I like your last comment there that pulling a higher number of cores is going to increase your accuracy because you're going to take out that stray core that just happened to hit right on an old strip. I've been talking with Eric Moore with Soil Warrior. Eric, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
All right, Brian, we've been talking soil organic matter, and Brian has rejoined the radio show today. And it's just a big deal. It's one of the questions we get a lot during our Ag PhD soils clinics in the winter. And if you're interested in coming to a soils clinic, by the way, we still have a number of those left. They're free. We'd love to see you there. We'll show you how to read a soil test and then show you how to build that nutrient program to win on your farm. Organic matter is one of those that I don't think people that come to the workshop understand how big a deal it is. But by the time they leave, they know, organic matter is a big deal, and I wish I had a little bit more on some of those tough soils, because we'll talk through how many nutrients come available through mineralization, but also the increase in water holding capacity and nutrient holding capacity that can be a big deal for a lot of guys.
Yeah, the nitrogen, when you talk about that specifically, so let's start with in terms of nutrients, it's nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. And the nitrogen's really the big deal, because we're talking a lot of times, and it depends on where you're at in the country, how much heat you have, and if you have a full season crop or not, but you could experience 20 to 30 pounds of free nitrogen for each 1% of organic matter for free every year. So if you had 5% organic matter, that's 100 to 150 pounds. It's a really, really, really big deal. The other side of it, like Darren mentioned, is the water holding capacity. So if, let's say, we were able to, over the period of our farming career, build up our organic matter, even 2%, which absolutely can be done by almost any farmer out there. If you dedicated yourself over your 30-year farming career, you could, or 40 years, whatever it is, you could easily get a 2% increase in most cases. I'm not saying in every single case, but in most cases you could if that was one of your primary goals. Okay, well, a 2% higher organic matter level, that means roughly 8% more water holding capacity. Might not sound like much, but could that be an enormous deal in a dry year? You bet. Could it be an enormous deal even when you go for 2, 3, 4 weeks without a rain? You bet. And when we talk to farmers all the time, they say things like, I want to leave my ground in better condition for the next generation. Okay, so does having more organic matter sound like a good thing to do? Sure it does. And if you want to check on your own farm where the organic matter levels started when your farm got broke up to put crop on it, just go into the fence line right now. I mean, literally, as soon as your ground is thawed out in the spring, just pull a soil test in the field and pull a soil test in the fence line and just see. Because in that fence line, I mean, I guess in most cases, you've got 2 or 3% more organic matter. Well, that's where your farm started. Okay, so that just shows you over time, whoever was farming that ground depleted that organic matter level. In effect, they mined the soil for the nutrients, for the water, for everything that there was, and it's more depleted now than when it started. Well, our goal as farmers, in my opinion, in a lot of cases, should be, hey, let's build this ground up. There's no reason why we can't have 2% higher organic matter level in the field than we do even in the fence line. It's absolutely possible. You can do it. And you can certainly be at least to the level of what your fence line is. But in many cases, that means we got to increase it. So how are you going to do that? Well, you got to reduce tillage. No-till, strip-till, something like that. Then you got to look at planting crops with lots of roots. You don't have to do that, but it makes it faster. So for example, corn has 5 times the root mass of soybeans. You can still build organic matter with soybeans, but it's just faster with corn and a little easier with corn. And then in addition to that, use manure, use cover crops, use biologicals. You do those things, you're going to build your organic matter level up. Your soil is going to be a lot healthier. You've got more overall soil life. You've got more basically, I'll call it sponginess to that soil, and you're going to have less compaction. It's going to be great. So ideally, if we could, we would encourage every farmer, get your organic matter levels up. Personally, in our farm, I'd like to see all our organic matter levels at least 5%, at least. And where they've started over the last 20 years, 2 to 3%. We're working on it. We're getting there.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with the Ag PhD mailbag after this.
Are there nutrients trapped in your soil? Unlock them with Tag Team LCOXC Liquid Soybean, a biological seed treatment that can help improve nutrient access with three powerful technologies: a nitrogen-fixing rhizobia, the LCO molecule, and a microbe that releases bound phosphate. Together, they help unlock nutrients that support root and shoot growth. Learn more at MonsantoBioAg.com/unlock.
With Preaxor's Xemium brand fungicide in your soybeans, it's hard to know which comes first: disease control or plant health. Preaxor fungicide is proven to deliver both with consistent performance, so your soybean crops get plant health benefits like growth efficiency and stress tolerance, plus longer-lasting disease protection, all contributing to maximum yield potential. Grow smart with BASF and Preaxor fungicide. Talk to your retailer today. BASF. We create chemistry. Always read and follow label directions.
Farming in the dark? We've flipped the switch on. More insights, more options for more farmers. Introducing Smart Insight daily satellite imagery, on-farm weather stations, crop modeling, scouting, alerts, available in more locations than ever before. Smart Insight, the only crop monitoring and digital agronomy solution with daily insights. Visit farmersedge.ca for details.
I'm standing under a very tall bridge waiting to talk about new Culex wheat herbicide with a satisfied user who's about to bungee jump from the top. Here he comes, sir.
Culex lets you plant the crops you want, when you want, while controlling difficult weeds.
What he's saying is that only Culex wheat herbicide combines strength with flexibility, a powerful new active ingredient that keeps your crop rotation options open. Learn more at flexibleweedcontrol.com or visit your local retailer.
Culex!
Strength and flexibility. Good for bungee jumps, good for wheat growers, bad for interviews.
One thing growers need to succeed is freedom to choose what they put in their fields. That's why FMC Freedom Pass Agronomic Rewards make it easy and economical to pair your favorite seed brand with products proven to protect crops throughout the season. Choosing Authority brand herbicides and other proven FMC products pays more than ever before. Calculate your potential incentive at fmcagus.com/fmcfreedompass today. Always read and follow label directions. Authority brand herbicides are not registered for sale or use in California.
Don't let resistant weeds cause problems in your corn. Partner up with a tank mix of Impact Herbicide and Roundup WeatherMax or PowerMax Herbicide. Now that's an all-star team for overall control of resistant weeds, including water hemp, kochia, Palmer amaranth, and mare's tail. And because Impact Herbicide is the only post-emergence partner in the Roundup Ready Plus corn program, that's a team that earns you an incentive of up to $3.50 per acre. Get the resistant weed control program that pays. Ask your AmVac sales rep about Impact Herbicide. Always read and follow label directions.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD. I'm not sure what just
what did happen.
Well,
there?
we were trying to do the mailbag thing, and welcome back. You are listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Martin Studio.
Oh, we were trying to play mailbag music. So
yes,
that's what that was.
And okay. We were trying to play the mailbag thing, and it didn't work. But anyway, let's get to some of these questions. First of all, I got a comment on saline soils. We were talking about saline soils the other day, and got a comment here. Farmers out west who irrigate often have to pay special attention to salinity issues,
yep,
or else the soil becomes ruined.
Wait, stop. Let's talk about why they have to pay attention
to
it, though.
Here, it's coming up.
Okay, go ahead.
Oftentimes, the irrigation water is full of dissolved salts, and you need good drainage. And then what we're doing is slightly overwatering according to a specific formula so we can have enough water to leach out those salts that we're applying. Now, if you don't, the soil over time becomes so saline that only salt-tolerant plants can grow. And this is happening over large areas of California's West Central Valley and others where there isn't much rainfall. Thanks for talking about this issue. Love your show.
Okay, here's the other thing that ends up happening. Even if you have good water, if you don't have good drainage and you overwater even slightly, then it's very possible that you could have evaporation going off. And even if you don't overwater, you might still have evaporation. Well, when water evaporates, a lot of times it leaves behind salt. So that can absolutely be a real issue. But yes, I mean, we got to really pay attention to salts and sodium levels and all those kind of things. I know we're going to talk about that an awful lot at our advanced soils clinics coming up.
All right, got a question from Matt, and he said, I was at your soils clinic in Bismarck and went back home to look at some of my soil samples. I got some questions on soil pH. I have 2.5 acre grids, and I'm showing you where my pH is low in spots that I once thought were alkaline. There is salt in the area that creeps in from the sloughs. Is this a sodic issue? Will lime fix it? I attached my samples here so you could take a look.
Okay, so yeah, I looked at those.
So you got pH as low as 5.7, 5.8 in some of those spots, and that's in low-lying ground where a lot of times, you're right, Matt, we do see high pH in those areas, especially as sodium builds up, and you've got sodium-based saturation as high as 4.3% in some of those areas.
Yep. So the other issue we've got is high magnesium, low calcium. So I probably would put a little bit of lime on. I would not get carried away, though. I'd put a little bit of lime on, and I would absolutely get some tiling done there so we fix our drainage problem, because if stuff is seeping over, you know that seep is going to continue over the years. That problem very well could get worse unless you fix it. So tile number one, a little bit of lime number two, and then I kind of see how things start to shake out after 2-3 years and make adjustments after that.
All right, got one from Drew, and he said, our yield goal is 275 on some irrigated ground for corn. And in the past, we've had a co-op pulling our samples, and they have not recommended any micronutrients be used at all. Now, after attending one of your clinics, we started pulling our own grid samples and realized we're really low on several micros. Wondering what recommendations you'd make specifically towards zinc, boron, manganese, and sulfur. How much should we apply and in what form?
Okay. What we always like to do, though, is we kind of take things 1 through 12. So if you come to our soils clinics, we'll tell you what the 1 through 12 is. It's not that complicated, how you read a soil test, how you evaluate those things. But I'm looking at pH, that's good. And I move to cation exchange capacity, I see it's heavier ground. I go to organic matter, I see, ooh, it's not very good on the organic matter side. So initially, I'm thinking, you know what, this has been heavily tilled over the years. I don't know anything about your ground, but when I see 2% and less organic matter, that's not where we want to be. Over time, I would probably be reducing tillage, doing what I can to try to build those organic matter levels. So anyway, you can see I kind of go through this step by step. I get down to phosphorus, and I see, boy, we are really low. When you say 275 bushel corn, on phosphorus, I'll be honest, we're not even close. I see a lot of 10 part per million, a little bit of 20. That's not even close. So we're needing a lot of phosphorus. We need to get this ground, in my opinion, built up on phosphorus. And you can. It's heavy ground. It's not going anywhere. So I would, if I owned that ground, I'd be investing heavily in phosphorus. The good news here is potassium is really good. So we got a lot of 5 to 6% base saturation K levels. So that's great. I mean, that's exactly where I want to be. So I'm going to continue a maintenance kind of level of potassium, but I need to be in a build program with phosphorus. But yes, I see what you're talking about. You're right in the very bottom end on sulfur. You're low on zinc. You're low on manganese. You are low on boron. Copper's barely there. So yeah, micronutrients is a big deal. I'll just tell you what we did on our farm and some of these things. Okay, so I look at it and I see, you know what? I got four things here that I really could probably address. Sulfur, zinc, manganese, boron. When I look at all these, the micro side of things, there are some companies out there that have some blends that might even be just that. So we've had some fields like this before too where I say, you know what? I mean, I have no spots, not a single spot in the field where I'm good on boron or manganese or zinc or sulfur. So if that's the case, I can put on a blend across the entire field. I don't have to worry about variable rating or any of that kind of stuff. I just say, man, I got to get my levels built up. And then once I get stuff up, in a lot of cases, then we make tweaks with one nutrient or maybe two nutrients, something like that. So if it was me, I'd look for some kind of dry blend product I can use, and I just go spread that. And you're going to invest some money because you need all of these things. But I mean, in most cases, with most of these nutrients, it's not like you're going to lose them in year one or anything else, but we got to get those levels up. So yeah, I'd absolutely be working on that. But I mean, zinc, we're halfway there. Boron, we're not even halfway there. Manganese, we're halfway there. So we absolutely need some of those nutrients. It really should help your yield both in the short term and the long term.
All right. Thanks for the question. Really appreciate that. Got one here from Randy, and Randy said, just more of a comment than anything else. I attended your soils clinic in Morris, Minnesota. It's the second one that I've attended. This time I brought my brother and my neighbor, and now we're all looking forward to saving money from the information we got from you. Please keep it up and know that we really appreciate it. Hey, thanks a lot, Randy. That's really nice to hear. It is a lot of work doing all these meetings, and I'm glad you're getting a good benefit out of it. Okay, Wayne, we got a couple of comments here, Brian. We talked about natural carcinogens that plants produce, and evidently that was a hot topic because we got some response. First of all, this one comes from Wayne, and Wayne said, I'm curious why so many more crop protection pesticides are registered for use in the U.S. and Australia versus Canada and the EU. Is this climate driven, or does it have to do with your comfort in using them, or the cost, or what's the reason?
Well, part of the thing in Canada, they don't raise as many crops as we do in the United States, so they wouldn't need to register as many pesticides. I would assume it's the same thing in Europe, but I don't know. You look at how many total acres of cropland we have here, it's way more than those other countries, so I would assume that's what it has to do with.
Yep, that and politics, of course, too. Speaking of politics, Nick says...
I don't know that it has much to do with politics, Darren. Are there any pesticides that are labeled here that they won't allow? I don't think so. And in some cases, like in Canada, for example, they approved Enlist way before we approved Enlist. That's one of the more recent ones I can think of. So I don't know. I thought their regulatory is... I feel very confident in saying this, that other than the EU... The United States has the most stringent EPA, or you know, whatever regulatory body you want to call it, around for the other countries in the world. I mean, it's tough to get stuff through.
No, and it's science based, and I like that a lot of the politics are out of it. Okay, another comment towards the natural carcinogens that we were talking about. Nick said, what comes to mind is we've got lots of people eating these natural pesticides and building up the capacity to digest them with enzymes secreted for those specific compounds. So basically, Nick's arguing that we're used to eating the natural carcinogens.
So what he's saying is
we've got enzymes that can help us deal with those.
So we should throw more pesticides out in there. So, out in society, so people build up tolerance to that. I'm not going for that, no. I mean, that's fine, but I don't really want to throw a whole bunch more pesticides right on food and shorten the label or shorten the length of, pre-harvest interval and all that kind of thing. I wouldn't do that. I think our EPA is doing a great job.
All right. One from Rylan here. He said, when you talk about fertility, specifically on soybeans, and you were talking about pounds of phosphate, pounds of K2O potassium, these kinds of things, you're talking about pounds per acre on each of those, correct? It seems like higher numbers than you normally hear.
Yeah, well, we often talk about higher yield levels than you normally hear, too, because quite frankly, we're trying to look 5 years down the road. We're not so much talking about today sometimes. We're talking about, all right, like my goal on our own farm, I want to get to 300 bushel corn. I want to get to 100 bushel beans. Well, if I don't, get started, then I'm not going to get anywhere. If all I do is say, you know what, we're just going to fertilize for county average, even though that's 50 bushels below where we're at right now. I mean, that's not going to get me where I want to go. So yeah, we are talking to guys that want to look toward the future, but it doesn't matter. I mean, you can set it up however you want to do it. But yes, we are talking pounds per acre typically when we make recommendations.
Got a lot of Ag PhD Soils Clinic still to come. You can check out the full list at agphd.com. Just click on the events tab. Thanks for listening today. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.